Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.
This is the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There? And my guest today is Felicity Moorman, who is the vice president at P2 Smart Building. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Love sharing the journey with others.
I'm excited to get into this. Before we do, I want to give a little bit more of an intro of you, and then I'll kick it over to you to kind of talk about your background a bit. But I had actually first come across your name, I'm going back, this might be 3 or 4 years ago. We were both CEO report, Mid-Atlantic Leadership Women of the Year, I think.
Wow.
was the right?
Throwback.
I'm going back maybe 4 years. So I had first really kind of come across you then, and then obviously through that had been connected or seen you on social. And so I've been looking forward to this because I think what you're doing in the space is super interesting. So we're going to get into that. But first, a little bit of context for the audience. You are also the co-founder of Stratus, who was recently acquired, and also were an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, amongst many other accolades, which I don't have time to read them all, but certainly excited to get started with this conversation. So let's jump right into it. Let's first start, can you kind of set the table? Let's go backwards first. Give an overview or kind of an intro about you as a little kid. What were you like? Where were you born? Only child. What were you like as a kid?
Yeah, so I was born to teenage parents in relatively rural Oklahoma. The story writes itself from there if you're not careful. The only child born to those two. Of course, they grew up and made different decisions after that, separately, I should say. I realized pretty early on that I wasn't necessarily right for Oklahoma. I remember watching Bambi, and spoiler alert, there's this terrible scene for some people. Some people were fine with it. And for me, I just had this like epiphany, given the reactions in the room and my own shock and horror, that maybe I wasn't in the right place. And that's something for a four-year-old, you know, to realize that I was only born here. It doesn't require of me to stay. And so I don't know. I got the travel bug really early on. I was very, very fortunate in that my father was a union carpenter. So I got to experience a lot of trade labor and his friends, obviously, other laborers, and really gave me a significantly humble perspective early on as to what it takes to survive as a laborer. That was intrinsic to my person by probably age 8, how hard my dad worked to provide. Now, he was also clever. He would work and save 9 months out of the year, and the other 3 months, we would travel the country together in a Bluebird blue bus and see everything. And so, despite not being a military child, I lived in 21 states by my 21st birthday, and it was incredible. It was, in hindsight, a really incredible upbringing. As a 12-year-old teenage girl, near teenage girl, maybe not for everyone. I certainly missed those mall years, if you will.
That's where you led to where my next question was. What do you remember as a kid as you were doing that traveling and seeing the work that your dad was doing? What do you remember thinking or feeling about your life?
Yeah, so I mean, my dad is my hero to this day. He's the first person I call in an emergency. He's my emergency contact. I'm married 20 years and I'm still like, hey, could you call my dad? Because I lived with my mom during the school year and my dad during the summer, he would spend kind of 6 weeks of the summer, and I don't think this was conscious, but he would spend 6 weeks of the summer, the first six, understanding where I was as a maturing young woman, and the next 6 weeks of that 12-week summer, explaining where maybe I should go in my thought processes. And that's really, you know, he missed 9 months out of the year, the opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. And so again, I don't think it was a conscious effort on his part, but looking back, it was a little bit like boot camp every summer. You know, our relationship was certainly weird. Like it was really, you know, he probably could have been a psychoanalyst. He was like, he's getting to the details of all of my behaviors, my successes, my passions, and then very gently redirecting some, let's just say, misconceptions I had about how the world works based on my 9 months. And so it was confusing. My childhood was confusing, but I felt really well supported and cared for and loved by both of my parents. But there was definitely an extra bit of attention paid because I had that back and forth. Mm-hmm. Early on, it was a fight with Candy. And I have to tell you, I love that. Like buying for my affection with trips to 7-Eleven. That was super successful until my first dentist trip. it was definitely of childhoods. I really consider the first 16 years of my life to be a story in and of itself, mm-hmm. that could be told. But it was inevitably, as for all of us, intrinsic to who I've become, the work ethic that I picked up from my dad and deliver to this day, and the why behind it, not just work for the sake of work, but work for a passion, work for a purpose and a mission. That's profound. That's literally what I can never be satisfied. Me and the Schuyler sisters, like we'll never be satisfied, but you know, I'll never think I've done enough. And it's not a denigration to my own self-esteem. It's just that I always feel like I could deliver more to this very needy industry and very needy world. There's so many challenges that need help and assistance. It's not savior syndrome. I'm not better or more special than other people. I just see how much need there is. And so that's really, I mean, that's my drive. And that is directly from that really challenging childhood.
So let's go. I'm gonna come back to the industry and kind of present day in a minute. When you were a kid, what do you remember thinking you wanted to be? And I always need to work on how I ask this question, because I don't like to say when you grow up as if any of us ever grow up. But what do you remember as a kid thinking, like, I want to do that as I get older?
Yeah. So here, you'll love this. And if you've gotten this before, I'm impressed, and I need to meet that person. And bear with me. I remember my first want to do a job from age 4. Again, 4, very big year for me. so at age 4, I noticed that the sanitation workers in our neighborhood only worked 2 days.
I have never gotten that before.
And now here's the thing. Of course, they didn't only work 2 days, but they picked up our trash on Monday and Thursday. And I thought, what a sweet gig. What do they do with the rest of their week? Now, of course, I know and learned shortly after I shared this brilliant idea with my father. Of course, they probably work 6 and 7 days a week. And so it was not the appropriate path to take for career development for me. That said, I did the traditional kid's path of I would like to be a veterinarian. And then I realized, you almost only ever see sick animals, and I don't want that. Same with the pediatrician. I'm only here to give you stabby jabbies. Didn't want to be a pediatrician. And then when I was 12, I took my first trip to California. And yeah, as anybody from Oklahoma, I expect, I fell in love with the ocean. And I thought certainly marine biology would be my path. And I actually went to school to study marine biology and did for a full year, ended up majoring in biology as my first major. And then I just realized to be frank, I love scientists, but those are not the people I needed to spend my time with. Uh-huh. I did not enjoy lab work at all. I did enjoy research very much, but I didn't enjoy being in a lab with a bunch of people who aren't talking, which was, that was my lab experience. It's not everyone's, but for me, it was a no-go. So I explored as a young adult, explored psychology, philosophy, women's studies, all in an attempt to find out why people make decisions the way they do and how possibly to influence people to make better choices for themselves and hopefully the planet.
So I'm going to make some connection points, which I think you were going to do anyway, but so when you graduated college, what did you get your degree in?
Yeah. So biology, philosophy, psychology, and women's studies.
Oh, you weren't kidding. Like I thought you were saying you dabbled in this.
Now listen, don't be too impressed. It took me 6 years. I kept going. Eventually I took a graduate course in psychology and intended actually to be a psychiatrist. Found out that I passed out at the sight of blood, actually merely the mere mention. And in that moment realized medical school was not going to work.
I'm the same way. I see a paper cut and I start to get nauseous. It's so bad. I'm the same way.
So bad. So I did not continue either my graduate courses in psych nor a drive for medical school. Took a breather to figure out a gap year between undergrad and what I intended to do. And I ran a political campaign for a freshman campaign for a delegate in Maryland. We were successful. She became a mentor of mine. Tremendous woman, legacy politics in Maryland, Maryland is old school blue blood, you know. Mm-hmm. It is a legacy to be politically just connected there. And so she began to help me understand some of the things that I could do with my life that maybe I hadn't considered, you know, not just coming from Oklahoma, but living in a tradesman's home, if you will. Mm-hmm. Our aspirations were, if you get a degree, you did good. Like, that's enough. Surely you'll figure out what to do next.
Right.
And that just wasn't enough for me. I still had this drive and this mission-based desire to help create change that would impact and improve people's lives. So she wrote me a letter recommending me to law school. And honestly, I had my doubts. I really did. And I went to the University of Maryland. I had a phenomenal time. I was very, what's the word? Maybe I was a precocious law student, not intellectually precocious. This isn't a benefit necessarily, but I was very challenging to the status quo all of the time. I was challenging to the Socratic method. I was challenging to the grading system. I certainly wasn't the worst student they ever had by grades, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were more than one professor who was willing to say I was the most challenging student they had.
And so did you got a law degree there?
Oh yeah, I practice law. I've been a lawyer for 20 years. I don't practice actively today, but that information, the ability to understand legislation, the ability to read a contract and negotiate a contract, that's priceless. And she said to me, my mentor, Mary Delaney James, said to me, you may not practice law, but the information you gain in the next 3 years, what are you gonna do for the next 3 years? Dork around Baltimore? Yes, yes I am. I'm gonna be young and enjoy myself. She said, you can do this. And I was already running my first company, a marketing company at the time. So I did both through law school because I didn't want to give up my clientele.
So how old, so ballpark for me, how old are you here? Early 20s, mid 20s?
Yeah, so it took me 6 years to graduate from college. So mid 20s.
Okay. You know, it's funny when I was doing like a little bit, you know, I was doing a quick Google search, right? Like in additional preparation for this. Yeah. And I saw your name pop up and I saw Esquire. And I thought to myself like, no, I don't know if that's her because...
No, just Bill and Ted.
Yeah, just following. So the path I was thinking, but wow. Okay. Anyway. So how do you go from law to, and then you referenced earlier, actually, I'm gonna segue us a little bit for context for the audience. You referenced earlier the industry. Let's talk a little bit about the industry and space that you're currently in. And then let's go back and draw the connection of how you got there.
Yeah. It's a full circle moment. So unique and fun to do. But I am in the prop tech industry. So prop tech, property technology, real estate technology, and specifically what I do is around multifamily and student housing technology. So the acquirer of Stratus was RealPage. The P2 is Peak Performance. It's a technology stack that enables optimization of these very complex buildings and the management thereof. So it is a profound offering in the space. I'm impressed. I didn't make the whole thing. I made Stratus, but I'm impressed with the vision behind it. It's the reason that the acquisition occurred and the transition has been successful. And it's still a work in progress. No 80-person company goes into an 8,000-person company without bumps and bruises, but it is a vision, truly. And the leader of the company, Steve Wynn, is a visionary. And so, yeah, there's just more work to do now. That's amazing. You kind of think, I don't know, I didn't think a lot about exiting our startup. I certainly didn't start the company to exit it, which many venture capitalists would tell you is wrong thinking. Many venture capitalists told me lots of things I thought were wrong thinking, but I started it to have impact. Again, that drive to impact and improve people's lives, to reduce the global carbon footprint by 15% around the world in these very, very complex buildings. So mission driven, and my mission is held up in this new larger organization as a mission for all of us. So that's exciting. And we share, Steve Wynn and I share that hope, that kind of drive for legacy. You don't need to know it's me. You know, I don't need you to know that Felicity Moorman was integral to creating this technology and getting it into the marketplace, but I still want to have that impact. And so that actually stemmed from Stratus, which was a startup. It was about 6 years old when it was acquired. And I met my co-founder of Stratus while I was launching GE's consumer and home electronics brand, emerging technologies division, which is a lot of words, but basically I was hired to determine of 3,000 different devices or SKUs, which would be smart and what kind of smart. So smart meaning connected to the internet, mm-hmm. and how would they connect? Would it be Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or Z-Wave or Zigbee? And I came to that role out of real estate law. So there's your full circle.
Whoop. Got it.
Out of real estate law because the market collapsed. You couldn't get a job. Nothing was moving.
What year are you talking-ish?
Yeah, so 2008. So from 1995 to 2008, 2009, I ran my own marketing firm, which turned into legal services once I became a lawyer. So just really meshed and gelled beautifully. And it was always around, from 1995 on, it was always around real estate, marketing, and sales. And so that collapse, that global recession, I literally personally felt responsible for that because I was participating in that industry, in what is now my industry again. And so that's your full circle, like real estate to no real estate is moving. 18 months, mm-hmm. nothing moved. You couldn't sell a house. You couldn't buy a house. You could have bought a house if you wanted to, but nobody would have recommended it. Right. So straight into my first job. For all intents and purposes, I've been an entrepreneur almost all of my life, I did work at Sharper Image one summer.
I remember Sharper Image. So you said a bunch of stuff there that I want to unpack a little bit.
All right.
And honestly, I could talk to you for like hours. So I'm trying to condense my questions a little bit because to try to be efficient with our time. So let's start here. Then I'm going to back up to some stuff that you said. IoT, Internet of Things, for people that don't know, can you define it?
Yes. So, and it's so much more prevalent. Your mobile phone connects cellularly. So via cellular network, 4G, 5G, whichever media you're buying today, that's a connection to the internet. So that your phone is part of the Internet of Things. You're using the Internet of Things all day, every day. There's nothing mysterious about it anymore, but for the fact that you may not know how you're connecting to the internet. So I have a mug that connects via Bluetooth to my phone, which connects to an app, which connects to the cloud. It's a mug, but it keeps my coffee at 134 degrees all the time. I thought that was such a superfluous, unnecessary, like, I have 20 mugs in the cabinet. Why do I need an internet connected mug? Because it keeps it warm. It's amazing. I have to, you know, shout out to the makers of smart mugs, because it's a game changer. I'm just saying. I do drink a lot more coffee. You may be able to tell that. And then, and so anything that connects. So for GE, the consumer and home electronics brand, was everything from headphones, which obviously that's Bluetooth, right? Mm-hmm. We know this. You don't connect to Wi-Fi, because then anytime you lose that point-to-point connection, you lose whatever you're listening to. That'd be terrible. But that was my job, to figure out which was which. Now, when you think about a light switch, sure, you can put Wi-Fi in there. It's powered. But is that going to interfere with your other 100 Wi-Fi devices, your phone, your computer, the router? Are all of your light switches close enough to your Wi-Fi to connect? So there are communication protocols and standards like Z-Wave and Zigbee that create like a spider web or a mesh, so that these communications can jump from one spot to another without losing connection. So that was my job. That I will tell you something. I was supposed to, that's a business analyst position, lawyer to business analyst, not a big jump, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
It was like within 2 weeks, I was knocking on the CTO of Comcast door and challenging him as to choices he was making for Comcast. That's not appropriate. Who am I? We get along fine today, by the way, but that was maybe a bumpy moment. A little bit of hubris 2 weeks in. I was right, just for the record.
I love that you added that.
Yeah, no, I stand by that decision today.
So you go to GE. How do you then make the move from GE to starting a business?
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you something. I am a far better entrepreneur than employee. And I had been an entrepreneur for most of my life. I started in earnest my marketing firm in 95 and had been 8-9 years very successful. Really enjoyed it. The collapse of the market, apparently that wasn't my fault. That's good to know in hindsight. I watched that movie Too Big to Fail 8 years later, like in 2016. And I was like, wait a minute. I didn't cause the entire global recession. I'm really good. 2016 was a transformative year.
When you weren't in the movie, you knew that it wasn't just your fault.
Right? Like, okay, a couple transactions here and there that, you know, were, I knew that this person was going to have some challenge paying bills, but sometimes we all do. And so, you know, okay, all right, 10,000 transactions, a couple of ones that I was like, are you sure you want this mortgage? Okay. Anyway, big epiphany in 2016, again, like age 4 and 2016. Those are the two big epiphanies of my life. I don't know.
What jumped you to Stratus? Like, what problem did you see that led you to think, I'm going to solve this, and I'm going to solve this by starting a company to solve it?
Well, I didn't have a choice because of my challenges as an employee. You know, when you get a written warning your first day of work, that should tell you. I did. I got a written warning my first day of work. And okay, maybe it was fair. I still don't think it was. But that's a sign, maybe, that you should remain an entrepreneur. And indeed, I think it was 18 very challenging months. And when that was a contract. So when those 18 months were over, I think my boss and I both agreed that I'm really like, I want to work 16 hours a day and I want you to respond to me. I'm working 16 hours. Listen, my coworkers at Startup Life will tell you, I don't expect you to respond to me 16 hours a day, but that doesn't mean I'm still working and that's going to be there. And I'm sorry for that. But I just feel this perpetual urgency all of my life to deliver more. Like I say this to my co-founder. If you know that you have the technical capacity and propensity to effectively work, I'm not saying you solve the problem, I'm just saying you can move the world in the right direction. What, number one, you're obligated, in my humble opinion, and I have three children, and I tell them all the time, you are obligated by your privilege to solve the largest problem in the world that you believe you can impact. You are obligated. We're not here to dip our toes in the ocean from time to time and work 80 hours a week. That's not what we're here for, I don't think. I mean, obviously I have a strong opinion on this one because I'm raising three children to go deliver. But I say to my co-founder all the time, I'm like, what's the hardest problem you think you can solve? Because if you can see technologically, he's very technical, a super engineer. If you can see a technical solution that doesn't exist in the marketplace and I can push it with all of this, we owe the world that. Now, we're not done with energy management. We still believe in the original mission. It's taking so much longer than I expected, but I see a solution for that too. But that's, you know, that it really is, if that's who you are, if that drive, no job is gonna make you happy. I'm not saying entrepreneurship is fun. Sometimes it's really fun. I'm not saying it's not the hardest. I think that's the Army, the hardest job you'll ever love. Okay, maybe entrepreneurship is second to military service in the hardest job you'll ever love. Because no comparison, but maybe it comes in a far second. But it really is. It's hard almost every day. There are certain mistakes that you can make that just tank you.
So let me unpack a couple of things with you. And now I'm going where to start, because you have like five things that you said that I'm like, I wanted to dive in deep with that. So let's start with entrepreneurship. Let's start there. I get it as an entrepreneur. It's like one of those, the same thing with like having kids. Until you do it or until you have it, it's hard to actually explain it. The challenges, how good it makes you feel, how hard it is, how much you feel like everything's on your shoulders for the livelihood of other people. I mean, a million responsibilities, right? But let's talk about your experience with entrepreneurship. What is the best part about it? And what is the underbelly or the part that people don't often talk about? What it takes to be a successful, however you define success, you've laid out your definition, entrepreneur.
Yeah, so the best part, and I struggle with this a little bit today because I don't have control. No, listen, none of us really have control of everything we think we have control over, even on our best days. But there is this facade of control in entrepreneurship. Like, if I keep going, if I can lead the team to do this, it tricks you. And I learned that the first time, 95 to 2008, global economic recession, not too big to fail. Hello. It wasn't my fault. And I couldn't control it. There was nothing I could have done in that entire period of time to have changed what happened, still doing what I was doing. So we don't have the control we think we do, but there's this facade of control in entrepreneurship that if I just give more of me, I can have more impact and move this company. And there is some truth, despite the fact that there are factors we will never control. I love that. I love knowing that there is a direct correlation to my effort and the results. And, you know, work smarter, not harder, and all of that. But sometimes it's just gritty, hard, nasty work. And I don't mind that.
I'm hugging you through the camera, because it's like, I say, people, my, whether it's employees or just people, say it to me all the time, like, Lauren, you can't control everything, right? And not that I'm a control freak, or maybe I am. I don't think I am. But, and I'm like, you can control how you respond to things 100% of the time. Yes. And sometimes you're saying grit. I use the same word, and this, like, will. It's like you will a result to happen, to feel like you created what you believe is the best possible outcome. And not to use a sports cliche, but you leave it all out on the field versus pulling up a little short. And when that's done, people are like, well, do you know, what do you lose sleep over at night? And I'm like, I rarely actually lose sleep because I leave every day feeling like I literally did my best. And if I know I did my best, then what more can I do to give me stress about it? Right. In general, obviously pandemic, different things come up, people's livelihood. But anyway, so I wanted to hammer on that point because I love what you just said there.
Well, you said two things back to me. So I knew I was doing the right thing for me. It is not the right thing for everyone, but I knew that entrepreneurship was right for me. When I went to bed one night, my head hit the pillow, and it's almost instant sleep when you work as hard as we do. But right before I was about to pass out, I thought, this is every single day. Every day I have left zero potential in the world. You can leave so many things to others, stuff, more stuff, cash, businesses. You can leave so many things, but you cannot leave an ounce of potential behind. It's just gone when you are. And every night I go to sleep knowing I've given all of my potential away. It's all out of me. Rest well, my friend. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that you said reminded me of the quote, when you commit to a path, the universe conspires to assist you. You know, when we talk about karma and things like that, but many people lean into the negative karmic aspects, like, oh, if you do that bad thing, some bad thing will happen to you. But what about good fortune? And I'm not saying...
Not monetary. You're not talking monetary. Yeah. You're talking... Yeah. Yep.
But this is... I mean, this is very real. When you commit to a path and you put yourself out there like that, it's not spiritual for me, but you're saying things that resonate with people. Your passion resonates, and they may not be able to help you. And frankly, many of them won't want to come anywhere near that kind of fire, but those who do will. And it's, I don't know, that I don't think I can do anything else.
So that's the best part for you. What is the part of entrepreneurship that, and I want to, whether you like it or don't like it, maybe that's how you answer the question. You obviously can answer the question however you want, but the part that maybe people don't fully understand, don't appreciate, or the part for you that you find most challenging.
So I'm going to say this, and it is often an unpopular answer, but it is truthfully different for men and women. Access to capital, access to connections. I have had a lot of phenomenal mentors, men and women, but I have been, if you think of the industries I've participated in at C-suite level, real estate, finance, legal, and tech. I don't know that they're the most difficult industries for gender challenges, but they are real. And for many years, I denied them because I got by. But having been able to catch my breath a little bit and look back and see how much I put up with, how much I just let roll off my back, but that did not make it appropriate, direct threats, like, it is really different. And I, you know, it drove home for me at the beginning of Me Too. And my husband came in the door and I was at the dining room table working. And he said to me, his head was kind of down. And I was like, what's wrong? You know, 20 years we've been married. And this was just a couple years ago. And he said, Felicity, I was listening to NPR. Is it really that bad? And I said, oh, babe, I have done you a disservice. I shielded you from every ass slap. I protected you from every bad day that was caused by somebody asking me if I would step down as the CEO, if they would fund me. I didn't share all of that with you because I didn't want you to worry about me, because I'm okay. But yes, it really is that different for me than it is for you. And it could all be solved if I just learned to play golf, I'm sure. But I'm not going to do that. Little joke at the end. Not too heavy, but we all need to work on this. And my future, in addition to energy management, I'm adopting this as my, like, how do I lift women up? Mm-hmm. How do I act as an escalator and just get that staircase up rolling as fast and as furiously as I can? How do I make sure people can talk to me? Women can talk to me. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot of work. I'm not kidding myself. And I'm just one person, but again, you and me.
We got it.
A little bit of will and grit goes a long way.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, one of the reasons that I started this podcast was growing up I was in tech staffing was pretty much my entire career, right? So growing up in that, it was also like pretty male dominated. And so I never had a female mentor and male mentors have been great. And I learned different things from them, but I'm a mom and a wife, and it's in my experience, it is different when you're a woman in business. I'm saying that I don't know what it's like to be a man in business, but for all the reasons that you just said, I do not think that any of that is an uncommon story for women as they're on the rise in their career. And so then I got to thinking, okay, I used to, and I still do see the fact that I'm a woman in business or in tech as an advantage, comma, I almost don't want to see it because it's more unique, comma, I don't want to see it that way. I want it to see I'm not unique, right? As owning a woman business in technology. Yep. So we've definitely got some work to do there, but sounds like we're both on it. And I know a bunch of other women and men are tied to that same mission. So
no doubt.
So let me go back to you for a little bit. A couple more questions, because I want to be mindful of our time too. What would you say is the one or two lessons that you learned from your parents, either individually or together?
Yeah. So definitely learned work ethic. Just having a laborer as a father, who didn't begrudge it. That's what he wanted to do. He could have gone to college, and he knew that he was meant to be a tradesman. But that was profound as an example, and I'm forever grateful. Both of my parents were unintentionally building up my resilience by moving from one parent to another, by moving from one state to another, traveling, just that lack of, you know, you talk about stability for children and how important it is. Sometimes the exact opposite can result in a very different skill set, but at least an equally valuable skill set. So unintentionally, they created just this incredible reserve of resilience in me, that experience of, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. I have to live in Alaska for a summer. Sure, Dan. You begin to build resilience and you begin to build perspective. Those two things combined, the resilience with the work ethic, are just, they might be the two characteristics that others would point to for defining me.
I have three more questions, so I want to go at them quickly and maybe 30-second answers because I want to get to
challenge.
All of them. Yeah, right? Because I want to get to all of them, because it'll be really valuable. So the first one is talk a little bit about work-life integration. Being a parent, starting a business, working a lot of hours. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so for me, this is where entrepreneurship is the biggest blessing of all. I work with my kids. My kids work with me. They work for me. I hire them. They don't hire me because they can't afford me. But but I do. All three of my children have worked probably years of their life. Some paid, some just, you know, you need to learn this, so you're going to do it. Or I need help now. We have to ship these to China today. And I thought that I had scared them away from entrepreneurship, from work ethic, maybe. That's stupid ethic, Mom. My oldest daughter just started her own company. And I was like, oh, what? So I was like, baby, don't you want to go to law school? It'll be fun. And she's like, I will, but I want to start this company. And I just was blown away that I didn't terrify her away with the amount of meshing of the two that I do. I never missed a thing, though. I never missed a performance because I'm an entrepreneur. And my coworkers, my teammates, they don't miss stuff either because they see me model that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the biggest, honestly, as a woman who would otherwise be challenged in the perception of my absence, even though I'm working 16 hours a day, that's been the biggest blessing of entrepreneurship, is enabling my children and being there no matter what. Even if it's not for, like, even if I don't ever make dinner, which mm-hmm. I don't enjoy cooking. I'm not creative in the kitchen. So what?
You
went to every
strengths.
Single one of your performances. You're welcome. And they were great. That's what I wanted to do with my time.
Yep. I love that.
That was not a 30-second answer.
No, but that was perfect. But I want to be mindful of your time. So I'm going to two more. I'm going to try to sneak them in.
Okay, let's go.
What would you tell your younger self?
I would give myself John Lennon's quote much, much earlier, because everything felt catastrophic growing up. And it does for all of our kids, by the way. It doesn't matter how privileged our kids are or how hard their life is. Everything feels catastrophic because it's the first time they're experiencing it, whether it's moving to Alaska or whether it's not getting the dress you wanted for prom. It's all catastrophic. And we just have to remember that it is. But I would have told myself at maybe... probably could have incorporated it into my life at 10 or 11. In the end, it will be okay. If it's not okay, it's not the end. Just keep going.
I love that. Last question before I get to rapid fire. How would you define success?
That complete and total extinguishing of potential. Maybe I didn't get the impact I wanted. Maybe I don't leave the legacy. Maybe nobody remembers my name. But if I lived every single day that fully, and listen, sometimes we have bad days, don't get me wrong, but if I did extinguish that potential every day, if I really hit that pillow and think, that's it, that's all I have, that's it, that's for me, that's what I'm here for.
Love that. I'm gonna go rapid fire. So these are six questions. You pick one of the choices and then we'll wrap up. All right. Netflix or cable?
Netflix, definitely. I haven't had cable in almost 20 years.
Sky or grass?
Sky. Love to fly.
Beach or mountain?
Beach.
Text or call?
Oh, please don't call me ever.
Stone or brick?
Brick. I'm a city girl.
Astronaut or deep sea diver?
Deep sea diver, actually.
What? That's...
Yeah.
Wow.
Scuba, and I'm working on my pilot's license. So Scott, way up high, way down low. Let's
oh my gosh.
Almost extremes all the time.
That's awesome. Coffee or tea?
Yes. I do coffee until noon now, and I had to stop drinking. I would drink coffee all day. I had to stop and switch to a decaffeinated tea that also had the opposite pH of coffee so that I didn't die.
All right, and the last one, cat or dog?
Dogs, all the time, every dog.
So funny.
Do you remember that song? I love cats. I love every kind of cat. And it went viral and it was great. That's me with dogs.
Is there anything else? We're going to wrap up now because I know you have a meeting that you have to bounce to. Anything else that you want to cover or talk about quickly before we end?
Just one thing. You know, we're coming out of a pandemic and a lot of women have left their jobs because their partners are higher wage earners. It's endemic of pay inequity. So we're gonna have to work on that. But if you left your career or your job, can you just pause for 1 second and think, do I wanna go back to that industry or that career? Because maybe this terrible moment presents an opportunity for you to come into technology with me. Maybe you can come to me. And there's pay inequity in technology, but the pay is good and it will continue to be good. And it's not a future-proof industry. And we have layoffs like everyone else, but if you weren't happy, maybe think about technology. You don't have to code to be a technologist. You don't have to code to tell the story. Coders don't necessarily tell the best marketing stories. They don't necessarily hire the best. They don't necessarily take care of culture. Some do. But maybe come over to tech, come over and try something new. If you're gonna have to transition anyway, get paid and enjoy yourself. for the rest of your career. Just saying, just a thought.
I love this. I so much enjoyed talking with you. We'll have to get together post pandemic for like coffee or drink or something.
I feel like we're kindred.
Yeah, come back down to Baltimore.
I haven't been since the pandemic, so I cannot wait.
We'll go around your old stomping grounds.
Yes. The people will be terrified to see me.
Felicity, thank you so much. Again, my guest, Felicity Moorman. I'm going to link everything up that she's doing in the podcast notes. Thanks so much for being here. It was wonderful talking with you.
Lauren, thank you. Pleasure's mine. Appreciate the time.
Take care.
Bye.
Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.